From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, an unusual Torah comes to Sacramento, one of many confiscated during the Holocaust. Plus, music from Kings and Thieves, the new CD from folk singers Richard March and Tyler Regal, and Sound Advice reviews the best indie music of 2009. First, this is officially the day of inclusion in California, recognizing the repeal of the 19th century Chinese Exclusion Act. For decades, that law made it difficult for Chinese and Chinese-descended people to live and work in California. Although the Chinese Exclusion Act was repealed a long time ago, the day of inclusion is new. We'll start our discussion with the California Assemblyman who wrote the law creating the Day of Inclusion. He's Democratic Assemblyman Mike Eng, who represents a district in eastern Los Angeles County. Assemblyman, welcome to Insight.
Thank you and good morning.
Why did you choose to make December 17th the Day of Inclusion?
This was the day that after 60 years of, for the first time in history, the Congress of the United States passing a law that focused on one ethnic group and ending it 60 years later on December 17th in 1943, we thought it was appropriate to select that day.
Well, the repeal was a long time ago. Why did you think it was important now to celebrate the repeal of the Exclusion Act with a Day of Inclusion?
That's a good question. I think that considering the economic challenges that we face today and the tendency to scapegoat and possibly blame others, we need to look no further than the past in the 1800s where a specific ethnic group was targeted under similar conditions. And so we're doing two things. First of all, we're going to learn about the past so that we can look to the future and not make the same mistakes.
Assemblyman Mike Eng, who wrote the State Assembly concurrent resolution, that's the jargon, which created the Day of Inclusion, which is today. It's the first Day of Inclusion celebrating the repeal of the Chinese Exclusion Act. Also with us in our studio is Steve Yi. He's an artist and a leading member of Sacramento's Chinese American community. Among other roles, he's vice chair of the Yi Fao Center Advisory Board. Steve Yi, welcome back to Insight.
It's a pleasure to be here, Jeffrey.
Remind us, what were the main features of the Chinese Exclusion Act?
Well, the Chinese Exclusion Act, I think, was the first and hopefully the last anti-immigration, federally mandated law against a particular race.
Specifically, what did it do to the Chinese people in California? What were they not allowed to do?
Well, with the enactment of the Chinese Exclusion Act, states, one by one, rewrote their constitution to tell their citizenry to do whatever they can to rid themselves of the Chinese. Chinese were massacred. They were put on trains on the very tracks that they had built, never to be seen again.
And what was it about the Chinese that caused them to be the focus of the Chinese Exclusion Act? Because there were people from all over the world in California and the United States at that time. Why the Chinese?
I think the Chinese were very noticeable. It was something, we were a people that America had not seen very often. But what it always boils down to, decade after decade, race, immigration, and labor continues to be an issue in America. You know, misunderstandings and continue to provoke our national attention. We're still struggling to find what we the people and what to form a more perfect union truly means.
Assemblyman Mike Eng, what exactly is happening today on the Day of Inclusion? I mean, obviously it's recorded in the state's records that this is a Day of Inclusion, but I'm guessing that something more concrete is also happening.
Yes, we'd like to especially focus attention on some particular points in history, particularly in California, that marked the anti-Chinese discriminatory laws. For example, right in Los Angeles, there was a mob of about 500 people that congregated very close to the downtown area in Los Angeles Street. And when the smoke had cleared, they had burned down every Chinese establishment and murdered about 13 people. And they arrested about a dozen people. None of them were ever brought to justice. We want to focus attention to that particular site so that our young people can learn about it. Families can come and visit the six plaques that are placed there to commemorate that. Many people, including myself, had not known of that particular site until just a couple of weeks ago when we had our Day of Inclusion. Just north of Sacramento, we also want to focus on the contributions of the Chinese in starting the Transcontinental Railroad right here on the West Coast, where they were given implements no larger than sometimes than a spatula, and having to dig out a mountain that was sometimes 60 feet tall. And then they themselves were dropped into a very narrow space to detonate the dynamite, and sometimes many of them died giving their lives so that the railroad could be built. And then even further north, Angel Island, as we know, from 1910 to 1940, over a million Asian immigrants were processed there, and many of them were held for days, weeks, months, and even years during the Chinese Exclusion Act until the repeal in 1943. Mm-hmm. That's an important historical site, and we think we want to have people visit there and learn about our history so that we don't make the same mistake, but also at the same time recognize the contributions of immigrants to not just California, but this great nation.
I think it's curious that the act, the Chinese Exclusion Act, was repealed during World War II, because that was at the same time as Japanese and Japanese Americans, on the West Coast anyway, were rounded up and sent to internment camps. Can you explain what happened to cause these rather different directions for two Asian and Asian immigrant groups in the United States, Assemblyman?
Yeah, that's a good question. As soon as the Chinese Exclusion Act went into effect, it's interesting to note that within about a five-year period between 1882 and 1886, there were about 17 cases brought by Chinese Americans that went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. And these were cases in which the Chinese challenged many times discriminatory laws that targeted them. For example, the Chinese were the only ethnic group to have, or the only group, period, to have wooden dry cleaning establishments in the Bay Area, and yet there were laws passed against wooden dry cleaning establishments. There were laws saying that the Chinese couldn't own land, they couldn't marry, these laws eventually found their way into the Supreme. These laws that were challenged, and those cases found their way into the U.S. Supreme Court. And I think that was the impetus to repeal the act in December of 1943.
Yes. Stevie, any other comment on that?
Well, you know, these stories of the Chinese, you know, when I talk to other people who had not heard of this history, they say, you know, we have a history similar. The ACR 76 that commemorates the Day of Inclusion includes all immigrants. It's the fear that leads to this type of bigotry. Later on, we find that the fears are unfounded. Later on, we find that, hey, these immigrants are great contributors to this state. So the Day of Inclusion is a day to remind us that our fears get in the way of our common goals.
Could I ask you both, when your respective families, the ancestors, first came to the United States, Assemblyman Mike Eng?
Yes, my grandfather actually immigrated during the waves in which Chinese were brought to this country to build the railroads. My grandfather, instead of working on the railroads, actually worked as a houseboy and as a nanny. And that's a very important marker, because many years later, when my father served in World War II and came back to the very site that my grandfather worked as a nanny, he couldn't find housing. And he was born in the United States, was about to graduate from UC Berkeley with a degree in architecture, and he got drafted into the Army and served in intelligence for several years, but he himself couldn't find housing and couldn't find a job.
So your grandfather lived under the Chinese Exclusion Act?
I'm sorry?
Your grandfather lived under the Chinese Exclusion
Yes,
Act.
And the horrible thing about it was that if you were here during that time, you could, if before the act, many Chinese came over, but they couldn't bring their families. So my grandfather literally was stuck here. He couldn't go home to visit his family, nor could his family come and visit him until the exclusion laws were lifted.
And what about you, Steve?
Well, my father was what they call a paper son, an illegal immigrant with false papers. That's how thousands of Chinese who wanted to become Americans came through this state, and they were processed through Angel Island. My real last name is not Yi. Joe Bok Yi is the paper name of my father. I may never know who my father really was.
When did he come?
He came during the early 40s.
I see. So just towards the end of the Chinese Exclusion Act.
Yes.
I see. Well, we've been talking about the Day of Inclusion. It's today. It's officially recognizing and celebrating the repeal of the Chinese Exclusion Act, which dates back to the 1800s. It was repealed in 1943. The Day of Inclusion is a new thing, and it was created by California Assemblyman Mike Ang, who represents a district in eastern Los Angeles County. He joined us by phone, and in our studio, Steve Yi, artist and a leading member of Sacramento's Chinese American community. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, a so-called tattooed Torah comes to Sacramento, one of many confiscated during the Holocaust. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. We've put some holiday gift ideas on our website, three of them suggested by yours truly. Find a link to the stocking stuffers on the homepage of capradio.org. Coming up in Talk of the Nation, NPR's religion correspondent Barbara Bradley Haggerty and her new book about the science of spirituality. Plus, NPR's regular chat with advice columnist Amy Dickinson and the best movies of the decade. Talk of the Nation after Insight at 11 on Capital Public Radio. A so-called tattooed Torah, preserved from the Holocaust, is now on display at a Jewish day school in Sacramento. The Torah's permanent loan was organized by Shalom School founders, co-founders, Dr. Marvin and Linda Camras. I'm so sorry, Dr. Marvin and Linda Camras. And they join us in our studio. Marvin, Linda, welcome to Insight.
Well, thank you so much for having us today.
Marvin, why is it called a tattooed Torah? Is this literally a tattoo on it?
There is actually a number on the Torah, and the genesis of the number was that during the Second World War, as the Nazis invaded Czechoslovakia, the Jewish community of Prague attempted to save whatever documents and memorabilia artifacts they could from the outlying communities. So they brought to Prague all these memorabilia, and they numbered the memorabilia for safekeeping. The intent was that after the war, they would return these artifacts to their original communities for continued use. However, the majority of the communities were not to be Jewish anymore. The vast majority of the inhabitants of these communities died in the Holocaust, and the remaining Jews that were in Prague aged and then either emigrated to the United States or went back to their communities. Of all the communities in the outlying Prague areas, only a few remained Jewish after the war.
Linda, could you describe this tattooed Torah? What does it look like?
Well, it's on the Eitz Chaim, which are the trees of life, which are the scrolls of the Torah. It's very battered looking. It has some burn marks on the pages throughout as you unfold it. It's obviously very, very old, and it is shrouded in what you probably would consider rags right now.
And describe the tattoo.
The tattoo is just the number on the Torah. Each Torah was given a number, and ours is 2, 3, 4, 5, 8.
2, 3, 4, 5, 8. So that suggests that there were quite a lot of these.
I'm not exactly sure how they used the numbers, how they cataloged it. I don't know what method they used. So I don't think that suggests that there were 23,000 items, although they may have just included that in all the other artifacts that they were warehousing.
My guests are Dr. Marvin and Linda Camras. They are among the founders of Sacramento Shalom School. They arranged for the permanent loan of a tattooed Torah to the school. The Torah was confiscated during the Holocaust. Marvin, could you tell us how you and Linda came to arrange for this Torah to be brought to Sacramento?
We visited Central Europe, especially Prague, approximately 3 to 4 years ago. And we went to the Jewish Museum of Prague, as well as the Jewish Museum in Vienna, where we saw many, many artifacts from the Holocaust era. When we came back to Sacramento, they were in the midst of building a new Shalom School campus. And we thought it'd be wonderful if we could link Holocaust artifact to the brand new school so that the students in the school could touch every day something from the Holocaust and have a link to the children who didn't survive the Holocaust. We communicated with the museums in Prague and Vienna, and the guide we had in Prague, there was really no memorabilia available, but she directed me to the Westminster Synagogue in London. And the story is that in 1964, the Czechoslovakian communist government attempted to sell their cache of Jewish artifacts to the West. And they discussed this with an art dealer from London. He had a Jewish scholar come look at the collection. They then found a philanthropist to fund the sale. And then the entire cache of Torahs, 1,564 Torahs, just from the area of Bohemia and Moravia in Czechoslovakia, were then transported to the Westminster Synagogue in London, where for a number of years they were cataloged, they were categorized, and they were repaired. And now these Torahs have been disseminated throughout the world as a remembrance of the Holocaust and to be used every day for education and for prayer.
So the intention is to actually spread these throughout the world?
Yes, and for use during the world, so that this has become just a remarkable episode in the tragedy of Central European Jewry.
Linda, what goes through your mind when you look at the Torah, this Torah from the Holocaust?
Well, you know, since Marvin and I were one of the founders of the school, we truly consider the school like a grandchild. We've gone through the hardships with the school. We have given birth to some of the new and exciting programs that are at the school. We actually saw the building, the construction of our new campus, which is phenomenal. And it was always in our mindset to make sure that educating our Jewish children is not only educating them as to what they have right now in the Jewish community and what they can offer later on, but it is imperative that they understand where they came from and why they came from there. And when this opportunity presented itself to us, it was just a natural thing for us to pursue, because Holocaust survivors are pretty much died out at this point, it's really important that our children understand what's going on and that they can, with a degree of education, respond to the Holocaust deniers that exist today.
What about you, Marvin? What goes through your mind when you look at it?
It's a link that I don't think I've ever had before with the Holocaust. We've been very involved in the Jewish community for many years. We visited Israel numerous times. We've been to the Holocaust museums. But until you touch a Torah and you look at the list that the Nazis created of the people from that community that was sent on a transport to the death camps and didn't survive, and the names of the children, and you realize the enormity of the situation, that there were 1,564 Torahs in one small area of Czechoslovakia, and they overran many countries, and that they had lists of all the people they deported, and you can see the names, and you can touch the Torah that these children touched. It's overwhelming.
Marvin and Linda Kamras are among the founders of Sacramento Shalom School, and they arranged for the permanent loan of a tattooed Torah to the school. It's going to be dedicated tomorrow. Also with us is Shelley Lavender, who's the K-6 director at Shalom School. Shelley, welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Must be a big deal for the school to get this Torah.
Absolutely. It's a once-in-a-school's-lifetime event.
And what about the kids? What do the kids think about this?
They've been learning about this Torah in particular since last year, so there's been a lot of activity, learning. In fact, just this earlier this week, our students went to San Francisco with the help of Linda and Marvin to visit the Jewish Contemporary Museum, where they were able to view a Torah scribe working on a Torah and talking about the key aspects of that. And in fact, in this exhibit, there is a Holocaust Torah that the children were able to see unrolled. And so our students have learned a lot, and they're making gifts for this Torah that it will be dressed in, and they're very excited.
What do you mean gifts for the Torah?
Well, each Torah, in order to be used appropriately, has to be dressed. So it has a special mantle or cover. It has crowns at the top to protect its wooden dowels, or the Eitz Chaim, as Linda was referring to. It has a special binder to keep it closed when it's rolled up. And at the High Holy Days for Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah, all of that is switched over to special dress. It's usually white. And so the children are making those kinds of things for this Torah. And so it will have new dressing for everyday use, as well as for High Holy Days and holidays.
How much do the youngest kids at Shalom School really understand the story behind the tattooed Torah?
It's a very good question. Fortunately, there are a couple of remarkable children's books that deal with this story at that level. So for our youngest students, they have heard a story that's very much written for small children to understand the big picture, and that this is a Torah that is from another time in another place, and that has a sadness to it, but a bittersweetness and a joy that some of these Torahs are still around. And, of course, our older students learn a lot more of the detail.
I would think that this tattooed Torah has, in addition to having great historical and emotional value, also probably has some considerable financial value, too. Have you had to take special precautions for security for having something like this in your school?
Well, you know, every Torah that is made is valuable because they are handwritten and they are they're unique. You know, there's nothing commercial about them, this one included. So, of course, our building is secure, and we keep the Torah that we already have in a locked ark. And the Kamrases have now had made for us a brand new ark that will be also secured within our building, and it can house up to three Torahs. So both Torahs will be in the ark. And you're right, it is something that we keep secure, but our campus is secure for many reasons, and that's one of them.
Okay. Linda?
I think what really sums up this entire experience is what we wrote on the Torah mantle that we are going to be giving the Torah. And what it says is, it's an honor of our grandchildren and a memory of the children of prestige.
Which was the town in Czechoslovakia,
yes,
that the former Czechoslovakia that the Torah came from. Well, we've been talking about the tattooed Torah, which is now at the Shalom School in Sacramento. The permanent loan of the Torah was arranged for by Dr. Marvin and Linda Kamras, who are among the founders of the Shalom School. The Torah will be dedicated tomorrow. Shelley Lavender is the K-6 director at Shalom School. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, folk singer-songwriters Richard March and Tyler Regal have a new record. They'll play in our studio. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Did you really like something in our program? Tell us what it was and why at insight@capradio.org. Tomorrow in Insight, the author of Plunder. It's a new book that criticizes the role public sector unions play in California politics. Plus, Anton Barbeau, the psychedelic pop musician from Sacramento, who now lives in England. He has a new album out, plus one he produced for singer Allison Seconds, and they'll both play in our studio. Back to today. Americana musicians Richard March and Tyler Regal have their own musical careers, but they've also played together as a duo since 2002. They have a new CD of 5 songs, and it's called Kings and Thieves. There's a CD release party this Saturday night, but first they're in our studio with their guitars, Richard March and Tyler Regal. Welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
Given that you both have played for a long time in various permutations and by yourselves, Richard, why do you work together as a duo? What do you have going with the duo that is different from what you do otherwise?
Well, I think pragmatically, you travel lighter, especially on the road and whatnot. But more importantly, we've both been playing music for a combined 30 years or so. And when you find somebody that you work well with and that's willing to work with you, then you stick with it.
Tyler, how do you divvy up the responsibilities in the band?
Well, Richard pretty much tells me what to do. We share the songwriting, you know. I've played bass with Richard for years, and we've done some co-writing together. So we kind of split it on this CD, pretty much 50-50.
Now, you got your guitars with you. You're going to do, what's the first song you're going to do?
We're going to do a song called Forever Down the Road. That's words by Tyler Regal and music by Richard March.
And there's a recorded version of this in the CD.
Indeed.
But this is in our studio. It's Richard March and Tyler Regal.
1, 2, 3, 4. On the outskirts and the edges, in the alleys of your mind, you walk 1,000 miles all alone. Now the barroom's cracked and the thunder's back, and you have no voice to sing. You're stepping through those curtains all alone. These empty seeds are sown forever down the road. Seems the faces of a heartache don't matter so much now, though you can't forget how hard the winds have blown. Creatures now are silent and the poet's gone to bed. Through the darkness comes a crackle of a phone, a voice you've never known, forever down the road. You make your stand not where you plan, shake it off and let it go. Faith runs thin through talk and waiting games. Feel its bounding rhythm rumbling through your bones. No, you've never been alone, forever down the road. Prayers turned upside down. You suppose it doesn't matter anymore. Watch dancers spinning, smiling, sweetly ebb and flow. Feel the wheels and ask not where they go. We're not that far from home, forever down the road. You make your stand not where you plan, shake it off and let it go. Faith runs thin through talk and waiting games. Feel its bounding rhythm rumbling through your bones. Though you've never been alone, forever down. We'll be right back.
Forever Down the Road, played in our studio by Richard March and Tyler Regal. It's also one of the songs on their new CD, Kings and Thieves. There's a CD release party this Saturday night at Java Lounge. You both write words and music. Tyler, why did you write the words for this one and Richard write the music?
Well, I've been writing songs on my own for years, just like Richard. And in this case, I had some words that I'd had laying around that I really liked, and I'd never been able to come up with some chords that I thought suited it. And so I passed the words along to Richard and just to see what he could come up with. And he came up with some nice changes and a nice melody to go along with it.
Yeah. Had you some musical ideas that you shared with him first?
I don't think so, not with separate. This one. Did I share anything? I don't
maybe,
think so.
Maybe fragments on the chorus.
Yeah, maybe just a little bit, but I'd say it's mostly 95% his tune.
Richard, why are there only 5 songs on the CD? Some people are going to go, hey, why aren't there 10 or 12?
Well, it's an EP, and it's an acoustic. We wanted to sort of represent what we do as a duo. We're currently, I'm working on another, what's my 5th full band CD, and so that's hopefully coming later in the year, but... typically, it's not unheard of, you know, to put out a 5-song EP. In fact, what people do now is they don't even press. They finish songs and go straight to the internet with them.
Yeah. You're from San Francisco originally.
Yeah, born in San Francisco, raised in South City and Burlingame, and then I went to San Francisco State.
You did?
Yeah.
But you also spent some time in Nashville, is that right?
Yeah, very briefly out there, and then some family matters pulled me back, but I was out there long enough to play in some song circles and talk to some people. The one advice I got, I was out there, you know, and co-writing was a catchword at the time with, you know, people. And a fella who was in a big glass building, you know, listened to what I was doing at the time. And he says, well, you know, why do you want to co-write? Why don't you just do what you do? So, you know, the very short time I was out there, I got some pretty good advice.
What kind of music were you raised with?
Well, I think my... father basically had Johnny Cash and Willie Nelson albums, and my mother had Joan Baez. And then there were all the long extended Reader's Digest collections that my aunts and uncles had.
I don't know if your dad is still around, but did he know that you later opened for Johnny Cash's backing band, the Tennessee Three?
He did. Yeah, he's. I'm so fortunate to have parents that were supportive in that way.
Yeah. What about you, Tyler? Where are you from? And what kind of music were you brought up in?
I was born in Santa Barbara, but I was raised in Roseville, actually. And I was pretty much brought up with all the 60s songwriters and, you know, bands, Beatles and Bob Dylan and so on and so forth. And so that's always been my biggest influence.
Yeah. Well, you're going to do another song for us. Richard, what's the song and who wrote it?
The song's called Gold Star Cafe. I wrote this one. I was taking the train from Richmond to Sacramento. I love the Capital Corridor train. And I was coming back, and I had to wait for a train. So I stepped off the platform, and there's a place called the Gold Star Cafe, owned by a guy named Chester. And we had the failure of the banks had just happened. And I was talking to him about business and whatnot, and how it was slow. And that's kind of where it came from.
Let's listen to it then. It's Richard March and Tyler Regal in our studio with the song Gold Star Cafe.
Grits and eggs, Gold Star Cafe, rained pretty solid yesterday. Chester smiles even though it's slow. Talking politics and class, petrol wars and a market crash. 30 SOBs that dragged us slow. I guess we let them go. Obama, Obama. Funny how it's times like these, folks start acting neighborly. Step outside their busy solitude. Sure, there's always some that's scared of hoarding what they ought to share when someone reaches out a hand in need. Gosh darn greed. Obama, 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 Obama. We just want a playing field that's level, fair, and easy. Where hard work gets you where you want to be. Honesty. Mm-hmm. knows that has a college kid and mom and dad and doctor I can call when I get ill. Pretty stable history, no threats against me physically, but there's all kinds of ways your dreams can fade. I need a brighter day. Thank God this young man got the vote, but he alone won't save this boat. It's gonna take all hands to get it right, so we can sleep at night. Obama, 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 Obama.
The song Gold Star Cafe, written by Richard March, performed by Richard March and Tyler Regal in our studio. Obviously, from the chorus there, Richard, the song is about President Obama. How do you feel about how things are going since you wrote the song?
Well, I wish we weren't sending 30,000 troops into Afghanistan so that we could have a north-south pipeline from the Caspian Sea out to through Pakistan where we can get the oil. And I wish there was a public option available.
In the healthcare plan.
Yeah. But I think for the choices we had, personally, that's where I wanted to go.
Now, the CD release party for the five-song CD is at Java Lounge, but you mentioned to me earlier that this is a pretty significant concert for Java Lounge as well as you two.
It is. Nikki and Jake have been the owners, husband and wife, have been wanting to have us over there, and we finally got over there. Well, this has turned out it's going to be their last concert. It's been hard for a lot of people in these times, and things have been slow, so they're going to sell it. It may open again in January, but we certainly invite everybody to come out to not only our CD release, but to have a nice send-off for Nikki and Jake.
When you say it might reopen in January, you mean as something similar?
New owners, yeah. There's really nothing established at this point.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for that. Richard March, Tyler Regal, their CD is called Kings and Thieves. It's basically an EP, an extended play, five songs. Richard March, Tyler Regal at Java Lounge, also at 16th and Broadway this Saturday evening. That's in Sacramento. Thanks both for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks, Jeffrey.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, Sound Advice reviews the best indie music of 2009. We'll be right back. Listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can download Insight details at capradio.org/insight. It's Thursday, time for our weekly music feature, Sound Advice. Today we'll listen to some of the best indie rock, pop, and hip-hop of 2009 with Nick Bruner, host of Capital Public Radio's online music show Off Air, and you also hear him during the local breaks here on Insight. Nick, welcome back to Insight.
Oh, thank you, Jeffrey. Hello.
Well, we're going to listen to some of your favorite indie songs
yes,
from
sir.
This year. What are we going to start with?
Well, we're going to start with the first single from an album called Realism, and it's by a band that has become quite popular, especially over the last decade, called the Magnetic Fields.
Okay.
Everything is one big Christmas tree, all got up with lights and candy. All the world is turning.
Oh, I really like that. It's got almost a sort of creepy kid in a horror movie vibe.
We didn't get to the part where everybody starts singing in German either.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us more about these people.
Well, the Magnetic Fields are a trio, and they're known especially their last or the last 10 years, for putting out records that all kind of base around a theme. Most prominently was their three-disc magnum opus that came out in 1999 called 69 Love Songs. Three discs of nothing but songs about love in all different varieties, from jazz to punk rock to electronica. This really just ran the gamut. And since then, they've put out what's called their No Synth Trilogy, which has to do with a record called I, where all the songs start with the letter I. Distortion from 2008, which, as you might guess, all distorted songs. And then this is called Realism, which comes out on January 26th, and the lead singer calls it his folk album. So, yeah.
Great. Mm-hmm. Well, that's our first song in some of Nick Bruner's favorite indie songs of the last few months or so of 2009.
He's the
host
of,
I know, it's amazing, isn't it? He's also host of Off Air, Capital Public Radio's online music show. Who's next, Nick?
This is great. I am really excited about this particular record because I didn't know who it was when I first listened to it. It's a hip-hop record called Black Rock, and throughout the songs, the names keep getting dropped. They keep saying things about the Black Keys. The Black Keys. The White Keys aren't any good. The Black Keys are better. And the Black Keys are this blues band from Akron, Ohio. And I thought, do these guys know that they're Jennifer? Indeed, this record is produced by the Black Keys.
Oh.
We're going to hear a wonderful, absolutely wonderful track called What You Do to Me.
You don't know.
That is the bluesiest hip-hop I've ever heard.
Oh, that's fantastic. It's so, so good. That features Billy Danes, Jim Jones, and Nicole Ray from the record Black Rock. It's self-titled.
Wonderful. Who's next?
Oh, the next group is something of a noise rock collective from the L.A. area. They're called No Age, and they put out this just incredibly blinding EP a few months ago called Losing Feeling. It's out now on the Sub Pop Records. People who are fans of Sonic Youth should really dig it.
Band is No Age. You know, one of the things I really like about that are those two guitars. One of them is this really clean, gentle sounding strumming guitar, and the other one is just this extremely distorted, muddy sounding guitar. Wonderful.
And you know what's great about that is this is actually one of their most coherent albums. Fans of, their buddies are bands like Health, Abe Vigoda, Mika Miko. These are bands who are just kind of get up there and just make a lot of noise and thrash around. This shows the softer side of that. This is about, I think, four songs on this EP, and they're all more coherent, but they still have, it's nice that you picked up on that.
Who's the fourth artist?
Oh, who's coming up next? Oh, these guys are great. There's a pair of DJs from the UK that really gained a lot of attention in the early part of the decade called 07. Their new album is called Yeah, Ghost.
Thank you.
That's really nice. The DJ is 07. The record is Yeah Ghost. It sounds almost like music that's perfect for an iPod commercial.
Oh, it really does, doesn't it? Almost as though it was written for it. I feel bad for this record. It has gotten hammered, I think unfairly so, by certain online publications, and just reviews have not been super excited about it. And that's one of those songs, along with a few others on this album, that I could just listen to again and again and again. I just repeat it and repeat it and repeat it.
Yeah, well, I like it for whatever that's worth. We've got time for one
I'm
more.
I'm glad we got the Callison endorsement in there. Did you hear that, 07? You've made it.
We've got time for one more?
Oh, yes, yes, we do. I think so. We were discussing this, me and the producer of the show, Meg Sevier. We're talking about this next guy.
Producer of your show, Off Air.
Yes, producer of Off Air, correct, excuse me. And we were talking about who this next guy sounds like, and she posited that if Robert Smith and David Byrne had a love child, it would be this next artist.
Well, I can't wait to hear it. Well, I think Meg really has something there. It does sound like Robert Smith and David Byrne somehow fused, and even the music. You can hear a bit of Cure and Talking Heads, somehow the love child of those two bands a little bit.
The theme of the song about, you know, how death isn't such a terrible thing, and mixed with this just wonderfully poppy sensibility. The name of the artist is Jack Peñate.
I really like it. Well, we're out of time. Nick Bruner, thank you so much for bringing us some of your favorite indie music of this year. It's been a pleasure having you joining us for Sound Advice for the last few months, and you'll be continuing to do it as we go into 2010.
Oh, I'm very excited about what next year has to come.
So. Great. Well, and you can hear Nick's show off air. It's online only at smartrockradio.org. And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today's associate producers, Jason Kanger, Mara Ponce, and Miranda Fox. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Today's engineer, Evan Matzler. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard, and she is a person to watch. Thank you for joining us. Book by a Sacramento man takes on public employee unions. On the next Insight, Steve Greenhut tells you about plunder. Also, singer-songwriter Anton Barbeau is back in Sacramento with a new album. He's also just produced Allison Second's new record. You'll hear them both. And jazz saxophonist Eric Arellano returns home for a series of shows. You'll meet him. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.